It's me, John Atack, and with my dear friend and colleague, Joe Zimhot. Hi, Joe.
I'm back again. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's always such a pleasure. You are such a fountain of knowledge and information. Always find something out. And we said that we'd talk about this novel. I'm sure that Spike will make a better image of it for the screen, but there we are. Paradise Undone. A novel of Jonestown by Annie Dawood. I'm presuming it's Dawood, not David, because it's spelt with a W. Who is she teaches creative writing. And I had to let her know that sadly I don't have time to read the book because I'm deep in research on the infamous Charles Manson. And to take a breather from that, I don't really want to read a novel about Jonestown, to lighten the mood. So what I said was that as you've read it and written a review of it for ICSA, that I would cheat and talk with you about it. And also I don't I, I probably know more than I should know about Jonestown, but I'm by no means expert on any of the details. But for anybody who doesn't know, it happened in November 1978 in Guyana, which is in South America, and a group of followers of the Reverend, self-styled Reverend Jim Jones, ended up dead. I think it was 912 people in all, most of them, from my understanding, murdered, some of them suicides. This is, I mean, I read the first sort of, how much did I read? I've got my little bookmark in it. Yeah, I read the first 50 pages, and she's a good storyteller, and her dialogue is excellent, and it runs, it's a page turner, it runs along. The fact that I got that far when I, no, I don't have the time to do it says something. So how did you feel about it?
Well, I enjoyed it. I think it was a fresh approach to the whole problem because Jonestown, like Manson and Scientology and a few other unnamed cults, have been have saturated the anti-cult network news hounds that are looking, for information about this sort of thing. And so this was a fresh approach, I think. What she was able to integrate was fictionalizing some of the characters, that were composites in some ways of members and people that influenced the whole progress of Jonestown, and then keeping some of the characters in their real natural context in terms of name. For instance, Marceline, Jim Jones' wife, is named in the book as she is and described in character. There was not much deviation because there's a lot of history on what she said and did and so forth. She brought a lot of, she obviously did quite a bit of research. She brought, for instance, the details like the meeting with Father Divine, and because Jones met with Divine,
And let's say a little bit about this incredible character, Father Divine, who
that's a whole other story in itself. Just as
a diminutive black man who had worshippers in the United States, including stockbrokers and accountants, and shrines, and was believed by his followers to be God incarnate,
Oh
if you
yeah,
like.
definitely, including his wife, who was like God's wife incarnate. I've gone to a Father Divine cafeteria in Philadelphia with our colleague Patrick Ryan and others, and they had a place setting. Mother Divine was still alive, but had a place setting for Father Divine. It was set up very neatly, and as a meal for him.
So same as the office of L. Aaron Hubbard. Every Scientology organization is meant to have an office of Aaron Hubbard where there's a fresh glass of water, and they might not have the pack of cigarettes there anymore that they used to have because he did stop smoking in the last few years of his life. But yes, this idea of this little
Yeah,
place for.
there's something about enshrining, like the dead president's desk and having a presidential library and the Oval Room reproduced, like in the George W. Bush Library in Dallas. I visited that, and there it is. And it's you know, where he sat and where he did his business, and it's all.
And what books did he read? Are they kind of cartoon books?
Well,
Or
his wife
novels?
was the reader.
Okay.
And she did interest him in some books, you know, and he did read them. So yeah, he taught reading but of course he was dyslexic, so it was difficult for him, apparently to get on with reading and other problems that he had. But anyway, let's not get off on that.
Yeah,
but
not.
The idea that a Father Divine, that she included some detail like that is good, because it fleshes out some of the history of how this group developed and why. What she doesn't bring out is that Jones, apparently, according to one source I read, asked Divine what he did about his urges for women. And Divine suggested very cleverly that well, you know, it must be alleviated, and that's a holy act, you know, so it's permitted if you're God, apparently.
And
of course, this is where Jones got the idea that he is also God, because Divine was getting away with it for decades by then.
Yeah, I was going to let me interrupt that. A book called Karma Kola.
Oh, yeah, definitely, by Gita Mehta.
Gita Mehta, where she talks about somebody asking a guru who is bathing in the river what you should do when you have sexual urges. And the guy just grabbed hold of his own member and showed him what you can do about them. Sort of, okay, you know, spiritual satisfaction. Here we.
Yeah, don't get all hung up on it. Just do it. Yeah. So yeah, there was that side of it. What's that?
Preferably not in public.
yeah, that could get you in trouble.
And it should.
Besides, these days it would be all over Facebook. But that little bit of what to do about sex isn't included in her book, you know, but it was a big deal in terms of how Jones behaved.
Yes.
And I think Father Divine's imprint on Jones really changed him quite a bit of what he could get away with. You know, Divine was big on social relations, on allegedly helping the poor and, you know, mixing races and to get rid of the race problem. And Jones is almost a copy of that in some ways. I don't know if Father Divine had a legitimate ministerial license of any kind if he was part of a church. I can't remember. But Jones did. He was part of the Disciples of Christ. You know, so he was a legitimate reverend, or at least licensed to practice of and to a point. And anyway, getting back to the book, yeah, I read it through pretty easily. It reads easily. The story is told through several characters that are being interviewed by a reporter, and that drives the narrative. The reporter is telling the story, and she, in the end, at the 40th anniversary of the Jonestown massacre in a cemetery in outside of San Francisco, where a lot of these people are buried, including Jones himself. She attends in the fictional account with her cameras, the speeches. Jim Jones' son speaks, for instance, and that's more or less the climax of the book. And so I think the way it's told through people's perceptions and experiences is good. You know, like I said in my review, it's a fresh approach. It hasn't reached the, you know, in terms of film or a kind of documentary. For instance, Manson reached fictional fame in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That was a well done film.
Very well done, and
you know,
a
so
surprising
you could,
ending.
You could,
but
yeah,
but
yeah,
there
but,
there
but,
are half there are half a dozen movies about Charles Manson, let alone tens
right.
of documentaries. So you're exactly right. Jonestown, there are attempts at documentary, but you know it's kind of overwhelming what happened there. I don't think, you know, and in the sort of counter cult field or the cult education field, you have Manson, you have Patty Hearst, and you have Jonestown. These three chestnuts that keep going round, and maintain our confusion that with Manson, when I talked with this company called Renowned Films for making documentaries, and you know, 3 hours of documentary about Manson, and when I said, well, you know, Tex Watson took Datura, the producer immediately said, and Manson gave it to him. And it's sort of, no, actually, Manson talks about it in a negative way. And also, Manson disapproved of Watson and Susan Atkins using amphetamines, which they did secretly. And you go, so this idea of cult dynamics, where you have a leader and a lot of puppets, it doesn't quite work that way, that right. we become involved in what's going on. I got into a little bit of a public brawl. There's a woman who's a professor who every year puts forward a memorial for Jonestown because two of her sisters died there.
Oh.
And I was just frantically looking at the acknowledgements in this book because she is mentioned. Is it Rebecca Moore? Is that that woman? But she put forward the point of view that her sisters were not brainwashed and that this was some kind of choice. Now, one of the sisters actually killed her own child. And so I said, look, you've got two choices. Either your sisters were psychopaths, and you should be able to look at their childhood to find plenty of signs of that. It's a fairly noisy condition, psychopathy. Or something happened to them that made one of them willing to kill her own child. Mm-hmm. And the conversation ended very rapidly. And it is something that, you know, that we were told at first that 912 whatever people had committed suicide. And gradually, as more and more information came out, we found, of course, the children were murdered. They didn't willingly commit suicide. And it would appear that many of the adults were murdered as well. Mm-hmm. And so we get into this kind of on-off switch of brainwashing. You know, you're either brainwashed or you're not brainwashed, rather than the participation and the degrees of participation that come from groupthink, from entrained obedience, and then from the deliberate use of techniques to override critical faculties and get people to comply. And Jonestown is just too complicated. You know, I mean, I think with Manson that I'm finding things that really don't fit with what we'd like to believe. You know, this evil, manipulative man.
You know, there was a side of Manson who was a very tender lover, apparently. The women all said he was wonderful. You know, he treated them well.
Yeah,
so he wasn't abusive that way.
There were times when he was. There were times when he was sexually predatory.
Well, that's true, because he was using acid and he went off the rails quite a bit with his behavior. You're correct. Yeah.
But what you say, you know, looking at Lynette Frome's description, which I think is reasonable. Her book is not Reflections. Her book is not read enough, because she's not talking about awful, terrible murders. She's talking about the Manson she met, and she was the second, after Mary Brunner, she was the second person to join with Manson. And they went on this trip up to Oregon, and it's idyllic. You know, and you get that Manson he's a vegetarian. That's something that happens after the inception of the so-called family. But he becomes vegetarian, and he then wants everybody else to be vegetarian. And of course, for decades, He ran ATWA, his charity, environmental charity from prison.
Right.
We have to have a more three-dimensional picture of these people. Also, I mean, looking at his childhood and the horrors that he was subjected to, it's not going to make me have particular sympathy for him, because what happened was too dreadful. What happened to Sharon Tate, the LaBiancas, Tricoski, Stephen Parent, the victims, Gary Hinman, is too awful to offer any excuse for the behavior. But when you find out that, you know, at 4.5 years old, his mother was sent to prison and he had to go and see her through a thick, grimy glass and hated going, and was brought up in a literalist Christian household by his uncle, who on the first day at school, when he was five, he came back from school crying. And so his uncle forced him to wear his cousin's dress, his 8-year-old cousin's dress, to go into school the next day to make a man of him. So, you know, there are bad things happening, but none of them are excuses. They're all part of this fabric. I've what I want to do with Manson is to apply Alan Shefflin's social influence model, because Alan, as a professor of law, spent decades working on this thing that says, yeah, it's not guilty or innocent. It's how guilty or how innocent.
Right.
And quite by accident, I got to know Alan very late. We immediately got on with each other. We didn't agree. We certainly didn't agree about repressed memory. But nonetheless, there was a real bond. And because I was publishing a new edition of what would become Opening Our Minds, I wanted an introduction for it. And he seemed like somebody who could do that. And he read it and he said, and gave me this astonishing introduction about, if you want to get physically strong, go to a gym. If you want to get mentally strong, read this book. So that was incredible praise. But I put his social influence model in as an appendix. Yeah. And he read it and said, "This is awful. Who wrote this?" I said, "Alan, it's published under your name." And he said, "Oh, yeah, I remember it. Something was going on and I had somebody else finish it for me." And
oh, my word.
So he rewrote it for me, sent me that. And when I said, "So I'll put, Alan Shefflin's," and he said, "No, include it as if it were your own." And I was very baffled by that.
You know what that is? That's like writing the Gospel of Mark as if Mark wrote it.
That's it. It's a
Gospel of Shefflin, but it's under, you wrote it.
So like the Johannine author of
yes.
Revelation of St. John talking about, Charles Manson and Ron Hubbard. This is Alanine. But it meant that with his passing last September, I think it was, I inherited this model quite accidentally and sort of went, well, actually, I'm working on this Manson thing. And this is the perfect test case to say how responsible was each of these people and why and in what way. And I think looking specifically at Leslie Van Houten, that she served 54 years in prison. She was active in one murder, which is a terrible thing. If she'd not been involved with the Manson group, she would probably have served perhaps 7 years for this killing. But because whenever the parole board recommended that she be released, the governor would say, "I won't be elected again if I approve of this."
The whole problem. It became a political football.
Yeah. And we find
and plus the offended families naturally wanted the punishment to be severe because they lost everything.
And
they lost contact with someone completely. So you could understand that, but the courts weren't fair.
No, and she became an exemplary human being, not just exemplary prisoner. She had a master's degree in psychology by the time she left prison. She'd worked for years on a project, running a project, I think, making quilts for the homeless. There was another project where she was reading books for blind people. She seems to, and she was what, 19 when these things happened?
It's almost like, she was monasticized. She became nun-like.
Yeah.
And charitable in prison, which happens to some people. They actually become very introspective and good people within the prison walls. And you hope that would happen to everyone, but it doesn't.
How true the Birdman of Alcatraz is and Burt Lancaster.
Well, there's a lot to be, again, it's fiction when you look at it, even though it's based on a, in fact, I think there's, I've read the true story behind it and there are variations. But I don't want to get off the track too much because we're talking about Annie's book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And again, I guess you could use the same model you're using to deconstruct how we've seen Jim Jones as well, because he's his history has been documented fairly well from his childhood on. And he had an odd personality even as a child, so that may have been genetic, but there was also something to do with his father. I forget the relationship he had with his own dad. It wasn't great. And his mother was quite eccentric as well. So he was almost born to be a preacher, leader, cult leader, the way he behaved when he was younger. He wanted to minister. And he had a side of him that he really seemed to see value in helping Black people, you know, for some reason. And that became his sort of outstanding characteristic that endeared him to the left and to, you know, the rising civil rights movement and all of that. He took full advantage of it, unfortunately.
And he put himself forward as a campaigner for civil rights, as a socialist, as a campaigner for social justice, and earned all sorts of accolades and awards for doing that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Rosalind Carter sat with him at a meeting and praised him. And Willie Brown, the Democratic leader in California, praised him as a wonderful man when they gave him a position on the Housing Authority. You know, it's weird. Well, the one thing, just before I forget, you know, the cover of the book, when you look at the sketch, which is well done. It's a nice sketch. However, in my review, I personally felt it was wrong in terms of the impression you get. And again, it's this idea that someone can be that much of a Pied Piper where they're like cut out as the leader, and then everyone else is this groping sheep-like follower. And again, you know, that's not what she's really talking about in the book. It wasn't like that. Everyone had their own reasons for following this, and they were very complicated. And Jones himself followed his followers, like most cult leaders do. They're fed information. They depend on feedback from the followers. And then depending on the feedback is where they're going to make decisions and move them. Because if they move too far out of the needs and the wants of the followers will reject them. They have to be careful. They have to be careful to dance as they've been dancing. They can't suddenly shift ground very easily and get away with it, because some followers would get very angry. You know, what do you mean you're not God? You were God yesterday. You know, so now you have to keep pretending you're God. You know,
it's one of the perplexities in researching Scientology and the history of Scientology to realize that it fitted into definite periods. But and so sometimes the leader can make a serious change. So when Hubbard, you have the first period where you know, that first year in 1950, he's incredibly successful. He sells 150,000 copies of Dianetics, Modern Science and Mental Health. The first goes on sale on the 9th of May. By October, the publisher, and he's a medical publisher, Art Sepos, he's decided that this book is a fraud. And so he withdraws it. And as a publisher, he can do that. So the book has sold all of these copies. It's created this movement. It's become a fad. And then during the next year, it's collapsing. All five of the foundations that Hubbard started go bankrupt because he's taken the money from them and spent it. There were two psychologists running those foundations and one former Navy admiral. So he penetrated and got a huge following, and then it collapses. And for the next, certainly through the 50s, it just languishes. He's got a few hundred followers. He travels around the English-speaking world. And talking to the people who knew him then, those first tranche of people they tended to be people who were interested in science. A lot of them were electronics geeks who built things, and they liked the E-meter and all of this kind of thing. They would be science fiction fans, and you know, frequently it's said that Hubbard was a science fiction writer. He wasn't. He was an adventure writer who, in the end of the 1940s, wrote a few science fiction stories. But the majority of his output are cowboy stories, French Foreign Legion stories, that kind of thing. But he did get followers from that place. So George Hay, who invited him to the UK the first time, was a science fiction writer and a brilliant man. But their attitude towards Hubbard, who they saw him as, he was a man who'd come up with some ideas. Then in the 1960s, he starts moving towards being the source. And you know, you get this statement, I think in 1963, where he's saying, you know, there have been many contributions to Scientology, all of them minor. All of the important things were me. Whereas, of course, at the beginning, he'd, you know, there were great lists in Scientology 8008 and Science of Survival of the people, you know, from Leeuwenhoek and Anaxagoras and all sorts of people who'd, Freud, of course. And now they were all gone. It was all him. And in 50,000 years, there'd only been him. So you've got this change in the guru's way of thinking about himself. Then, of course, you get the Sea Organization in 1967 as the Sea Project. And he starts throwing people overboard, you know, from 25 to 40 feet high into sewage, human sewage in the harbor at Corfu. And you've got this tyrannical new presence. So you have a guru who's gone through a transition psychiatrically. He has changed. And some of the earlier followers hang on. Then you get the transition that happened in his demise in 1982 with his attack on David Mayo, his attempt to get himself separate from the Guardian's office and their massive criminality, which he had ordered. And he goes into hiding. And you get this new sort of far less intelligent, let's say, form of Scientology, which comes out of the teenagers, the Commodore's Messenger Organization, that he's elected as his screen to protect him, not simply from the world, but from the rest of his organization. He's frightened of what the Guardian's office will do, particularly. And he's frightened of what the mission holders who've made making all the money in Scientology will do. And so sometimes that transition can happen.
The leader in this guise might be afraid that, you know, of what might happen to them if the followers don't follow them. But what they take advantage of is cognitive dissonance. The followers don't want to lose their investment, their belief. And if they see these changes, it puts up a lot of tension. So I think the leaders that I've seen in some cases, they up the ante rather than just try to assuage the cognitive dissonance. They create a bigger model of themselves and saying, well, that was just a test. And now we're going to the next stage. Mm. You know, we are, you know, like, for instance, Marshall Applewhite, things weren't going well for them. And now he had to come up with a new crisis. And because things were getting stale in a way, and the new crisis, Hale Bopp shows up and, wow, you know, we can connect with this. And so the ultimate game is die.
Having been castrated along the way.
Let's ascend, because nothing else was really working. Mm. You know, so maybe this will work. And he convinced a number of the followers that it would work. And I think this happened, for instance, you know, looking back at Elizabeth Clare Prophet, when they had a lot of, Mark died, you know, the founder of the group in 1973, suddenly of heart failure. And she had to regroup and take command of this group. And so, rather than continue with what he did, she imposed her own version of things and began adapting more Eastern religion, took on a Satya Sai Baba thing, who was very famous and people thought was the avatar all over India, you know, where she had Afro hair and suddenly the mala beads and tunic like Hindus wore, a kind of a purple tunic they wore. So she remodeled the whole thing, and she also elevated herself to, at one point in that period, to becoming Mother of the Universe or wearing that particular title. Right. And so the cognitive dissonance of who's the leader when Mark died, because he was definitely the leader of the group at that point, had to shift. And she was smart enough to raise the ante of herself. And I think Jones did the same thing. I don't know. Manson, he kept increasing his power, you know, when he suddenly had thought about this crazy race war based on Helter Skelter. And they bought into that. That was a new crisis, a new elevated them to saving the planet. Mm. They weren't just hippies trying to do ecological good things and stealing a few cars here and there. You know, they were now going to save the planet, you know, after a race war, which they're going to start.
He was like Shinrikyo. Yeah, he was the second coming of Christ, and this was Armageddon.
And the devil and everything else. So I think that.
So you again say something about Om Shinrikyo?
Yeah. Yeah, they were also going to kill the world to save it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, enough sarin gas to kill 4 million people by the time they were caught. Just
Yeah.
and I'm led to believe that Aum Shinrikyo is actually larger now than it was then, but
Interesting.
still has quite a following. And of course, Robert J. Lifton's Destroying the World to Save It is one of
Yeah.
the classic books. I mean, I recommend it as the entry point to his work, because it's very much a mature piece of work, and he's really thought it through by the time you get to it. And of course, when he was writing about brainwashing in China, he wasn't thinking about it in a cultic sense. It's
No, not at all.
something that
Yeah.
we took to him from our field, and that he then, caps with this incredible book.
You'll have to look at that again. I remember looking through it. I didn't read it thoroughly, but I have most of his other stuff that he's written, which I enjoy him very
And
much.
what you say about Elizabeth Clare Prophet, the same thing, of course, had happened to Marshall Applewhite, that Bonnie Nettles, the leader of the group, was gone. And so he had to up the ante, as you say. He had to find some
Right.
way of going forward. And we have this, I mean, looking at video of him, this completely spaced out, dissociated human being pronouncing upon us all. It's just terrible. One hopes they did actually get to the Hale-Bopp comet and go somewhere nice, but I somehow doubt it. I really do.
Well, if you believe in universal salvation, which the famous church father Oregon did and got anathematized for it,
I knew he was getting, we talked about castration, so Origen was going to have to come into this conversation some way,
But
wasn't he?
the end game there, I mean, this is still a big thing, is that whatever existence is and whatever has created this mysterious universe we're in, and not answering why, probably the probability is that it takes care of itself. In other words, being itself is taken care of, and no matter what the hell we do, there's nothing we can do about that taking care of us.
Yeah, and
You
it
know,
probably doesn't care about being worshipped. I mean, I wouldn't
no,
worship. I
that's
wouldn't worship anyone that wanted to be worshipped. I'm sorry, it's just that way. Admire,
right. So,
maybe.
obviously, my whole thing about that is, you know, no matter what we're doing, how bad or good we are, we're probably going to be surprised in the end, in some form. You know, I don't know what that is. I mean, I'm surprised to be alive. You
Oh,
know, what the hell am I doing here?
exactly. It does
So
come
I
down
might
to
be
that, doesn't it?
surprised to be dead, whatever they call that.
Yeah.
You know, it makes sense, is all I'm saying. And so I tell clients of mine that ask those big questions, I go, just relax. There's something a lot bigger taking care of things here. Take care of what you can, you know, make your bed, pay your bills, do some charity work, you know, and stop thinking about enlightenment, you know, or whatever the hell that is. You know, you need to kind of just re relax the brain. And
I couldn't agree more.
live a good life. You know, that's the point of it all. So
Yeah, I mean, enlightenment was the driving idea for me into my 50s. I left Scientology when I was 28, but I got the enlightenment bug, 2 years before when I was 17, I was bitten by that. And eventually, having read far too much mystical literature, Buddhist, Taoist, Sufi, Christian, Jewish, you name it, I sort of went, yeah, it's Jiang Su in the end, isn't it? I don't know where I was before I was born. I don't know where I go after I die. And this is wonderful. This isn't this great. And so that, and I realized that I'll never be enlightened. It's just not going to happen. I'm not smart enough. And letting go of that whole cumbersome burden of trying to become perfect, as you say. Also, one of the things that strikes me is that in the last 150 years, the universe has grown so much. God used to be the God of the sun and six planets that they recognized. And that was all it was. It was this tiny little place. And then you go, well, actually, the Milky Way, 1,000 billion stars.
Oh,
Okay.
yeah.
Sorry, 100 billion stars, 100 billion stars. And it's one of perhaps, oh no, don't tell me, 100 billion galaxies. And here's me. So
Yeah.
what would I be worrying about? Does an ant
And
have a
at
soul?
the other end, the whole quantum realm, which a lot of pseudo mystics get into these days, I mean, that's an endless realm also. You know, you're going in a different direction, but you find nothing. Much like, you know, they posit black holes, which is basically nothing from our sensual point of view.
It's an inversion of everything, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, at some point, even this, you know, the scientists, that their brain has to shut down, and after a while, a cigar is just a cigar. You know, you're not going to keep analyzing it.
So, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is, as Donovan, that famous Zen philosopher, put it.
Oh, yeah, Donovan. Yeah. Of course, over on your shore. Yeah, so I'm wondering, you know, when I reviewed this book, Paradise Undone, I kind of compared it somewhat to Manson in the sense of its popularity. Jonestown, Jim Jones and Manson have taken up far more, Manson more than Jones, actually. Manson has intrigued more people as a thing in the cult world than almost any other individual.
And, you know, and so, as far as we know, he was the only proven murder. I mean, he started the Hinman murder. He savagely cut Hinman with a short sword and locked half his ear off. But he wasn't there when Hinman died 3 days later, and it wasn't him who killed him. He's only present at one murder, but he is the most famous serial killer of the century. We, of course, have Harold Shipman, who came from Nottingham, which is just 6 miles up the road from me, who killed more than 400 people. But there's a strange sort of glamour, and I use that word in its fullest sense. It originally meant magic, of course, the glamour. Yeah. There's a strange sort of glamour about Manson. He's like, in the 60s, people had their Che Guevara poster, and it's like the man with the beard has morphed into Charles Manson, with, of course, the Scientology stare, which is, people don't get that he spent 14 months learning how to stare, practicing Scientology. But there's something iconic about Manson. There's something, of course, iconic. Just this, you know, the what was the African, the revelation of the Ten Commandments, or what's the group called that? And about 500 of them died in 2000.
And, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, and isn't that incredible, the thought that 500 people died and there just wasn't enough media to push it out into the world? So,
you know,
we
also
touch on these things.
You're bringing up something interesting here. You know, the attention to Manson is that he's on a human scale. Even Jones is on a human scale. It's not that big. When you move this to something like a Stalin or a Hitler or a Mussolini, that is beyond a human scale. It's much more difficult to pin down, because there's so many more forces involved, especially political ones. But the discussion of for instance, in using your model, can you also do the same with someone like Adolf Hitler or with Stalin or with Mussolini or with Mao? Of course, Lifton has done a lot with Mao, you know, to look at his background.
And the Nazi doctors talking about what happened to, you know, 45% of medical doctors joined the Nazi party. 45%, more than any
when only 10% of the German people joined the Nazi party. So it appealed to the elite, interestingly enough.
And of course, we're told that Stalin didn't actually say one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. It's meant to be one of his followers, and it was 100,000 is a statistic. It sounds much better. But we do get to this point where the numbers just become, you know, 11 million deaths under the Stalin regime in camps. Perhaps 70 million, including the famines under Mao Zedong. And, you know, there's been a lot of argument about the biography of Mao, and that there was an answer to it. There's a book called Was Mao Really a Monster? And I think the answer is very simple. Yes.
Yeah.
Whichever way we look at this, there is enough evidence in the record about his relationship with his wives, about his incredible sexual promiscuity, which, given that he suffered from venereal disease and was therefore passing it on a daily basis. An excellent book, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, Strong Men,
Yes.
She's expert on Italian history, so Mussolini is in there. But it's that and the book on Mao were, it's very rare for me, but I had to put them down. That was just too horrifying to go, oh yeah, and Mussolini would beat up and have some kind of sex with four women a day, take him 10 minutes at a time, and the woman would come away. And Gaddafi kept women in his dungeon, one of them, I think, for 8 years.
Oh,
and kind of
my.
going, how is it that we permit this? How do we let these people into these positions of power? And what can we do about that? Which, of course, is, you know, been our obsession for a long time, to understand how you can help people overcome the kind of enchantment of, you
Yeah.
know, being involved with an authoritarian and abusive leader, and how to help people get through that, and what you can do in terms of prevention in the society, how you can, and of course, books that talk about it, books that outline, you know, this is a very approachable book. And if you wanted, you know, teenagers to understand something about Jonestown, this might be a much better approach than sitting them down with a grim documentary,
Right,
because it
I think you're
takes
right.
them into the narrative.
No, I think you're right. There is a the book isn't daunting to read. You get a sense of the person getting involved from different angles, from different points of view, and the power of Jones and his ability to influence in very subtle and sometimes very dramatic ways is brought out here. You know, he's not a cardboard figure in this book. You get a sense that there's a person involved in this, and he can be very kind when he needs to be, up to a point, and then be very cruel and indifferent, you know, which is a mark of a leader, right? In some people's minds. And so he could take on that leadership role as well and become the judging God as well as the forgiving God, you know, and to have the power of forgiveness makes you God in many ways over people, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
In fact, our courts work like that, you know. Back in the day when Jesus said to people, you are God, ye are gods, what he meant was, you are judges in the old word. You're in the place of God when you're a judge. You're making a final judgment on someone's life. And so the courts have to take that very seriously, because the law enforces their judgment. You know, and so whether you go free or whether you spend 20 or 40 years in jail depends on this God, this judge. And so the cult leader takes on this role of judge, of what's real and what's not, of what's moral and what's not, of what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do, and you know, and the courts are entitled by law to make these decisions. Cult leader becomes the court and feels entitled because of their position, and what's interesting is the followers want that judge to be there. That's what creates a cult, is they actually want that judge to be there among in their midst. They want this God in their midst, because it, I guess it gives them certainty of a path to salvation, a path to freedom, a path to saving the planet or whatever it is. It's that kind of relationship of we've talked about this before, of certainty in that judge, in that God that is running your life.
And we'd like something to be certain, and when we come to the, you know, the realization of our own fallibility, electing somebody as a parent who can make decisions for us. Jesus, of course, also said, judge not, lest ye be judged, as a statement about exactly what you're saying, the godlike powers that we give to people. And seeing, you know, with something like the Innocence Project, seeing that hundreds of people have been set free because they were misjudged, because, you know, evidence was fake. Particularly
yeah,
witness testimony is often
I think
wrong.
You know what's interesting about Jesus is he worked, but he like Socrates wanted the rule of law on earth, you know, and obeyed it actually in the end, and submitted to the rule of law, because neither Socrates nor Jesus would died had they not submitted. They could have left the land and become alienated or and been allowed to go.
Yeah.
You know, the Romans would have felt wonderful if he just disappeared and went over to, you know, France or somewhere and started his commune there.
Well, and there are people, of course, who think that he did. But
yeah, well, that's what I mean. You know, in our imaginations, we still want that to happen. We want to escape judgment.
Yeah, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, we want to change the ending.
You want to change the ending, right? And I think with Socrates, too, he had a choice to do what Aristotle did later, was to leave the land and resettle somewhere else. But he chose to take the hemlock.
Yeah,
because he believed so much in the rule of law.
And the Athenians were confident that he would choose exile over the hemlock. And
right.
About 5 years ago, I reread his last statement because I read it when I was about 14 the first time. And it really influenced me, this profound mind talking about, you know, what your life is and this sense of just keeping a hold of life no matter what. And him saying, you know, it's as Jesus said, it's finished. I've done that now. It's complete. And it served its purpose. And of course, with Socrates, had an incredible influence on once it came back to us through the Arabs.
Apparently, I guess what it's saying is if there's a truly heroic, meaning a good death, you know, that submits, like Jesus said, you know, lay down your life for your friends, but you know, for whatever that friendship is, that can survive as a legacy, which influences other people more so than the person did when they were alive. But if it's a bad death, like a Manson, you know, then you have this kind of sick legacy, which still attracts people, but it doesn't really stick. You know, it's not self-nurturing. It doesn't grow in the sense of cultivating a good harvest or whatever. It's something oddly sick about it. Like Hubbard's death is an oddly sick death. It wasn't a healthy death.
No.
And I mean that socially and politically and theologically and all of that. You know, he was a very sick, unhealthy death. The same in a sense, Elizabeth by prophet, you know, look back at her. She was holding on to a fantasy of herself and willing to drag a lot of people into that in many different ways. Luckily, they didn't have a mass suicide. They did have a huge bomb shelter waiting for the end that could hold around 2,000 people. And that freaked a lot of people out. What are they going to do down there? What if it doesn't end? What if they end themselves? You know, that was the question. And of course, they came out the next day. Nothing had changed except that they had to go and eat and go back to work again.
And pay off all the money that they'd invested in building a bomb shelter for 2,000 people.
That was insane. Yeah. I think that's a whole other story. I haven't read much about what's happened to that facility. I know for years after, the group used to go down and use segments of it to play bingo and do other things like that. You know, it was kind of like a retreat facility underground. but it was also, according to inside information I had, people that have been down there, just running with mice and vermin and gotten into different,
as you'd expect,
foodstuffs. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because no one was going to manage that thing again. It's too expensive.
No, yeah. It's an incredible thing. It's come back to me. The African group was called the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments. And
oh, yes. Yeah, there's the Ten Commandments, right.
They
right.
got the date of the new millennium wrong. Of course, the new millennium started in 2001. The old one was finished in 2000. In 2001. But yes, they, I don't know much about it, but it was recorded as a mass suicide, 500 people. And you know, we should know more about that. I think it's very important.
So there's no implication of murder there at all?
I don't know. I don't know enough to say.
I don't recall hearing anything. I know you could call it murder in the sense of very persuasive, coercive language to die. You know, if you want to call that murder, you talk someone into dying.
I think it is. I think if you convince somebody who is, you know, sound of limb and sound of mind that they should kill themselves, then you you've engaged in a murderous pursuit. I mean, Norman Cohen, the great historian who wrote Pursuit of the Millennium, which was very influential in my departure from Scientology. It's a history of millenarian movements, particularly around the year 1250. There were more then than around the year 1000. But the Crusades are part of millenarian movement that starts in the 11th century. The idea very much that the revelation of St. John the Divine will be fulfilled, even though it wasn't written by St. John the Divine, but a Johannine follower.
Somebody wrote it. Stop, you know, been written.
it's fantastic. A few weeks ago, I was in Nicaea, where the first church council was held in 325 AD, and where the Nicene Creed, I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth, was written by Saint Athanasius. He wasn't a saint at the time, he became one later. And this was, I am just so caught up in, and have been since my teens, when I tried to read Eusebius and the history of the church fathers and origin and things like that, that this fascinating logic to realize that it's that late on, 325, they're arguing about whether Jesus has the divine nature, whether the divine nature is separate in him, duophysite, from his physical nature. And they're particularly arguing against a man called Arius.
Right.
It's that late that the decision is made of what the canon is. What are the books that should feature in the New Testament and the Old Testament, for that matter, because it's not identical to Torah, the Jewish origin. What should be there? And they decide that they're going to include the revelation of St. John the Divine. As far as I understand it, the reason they decide is because it is believed that it was actually produced by St. John the disciple, who, of course, is the only gospeler to have spent any time with Jesus. The synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as you know, are written by pupils of Paul, who also never met Jesus. So there's this idea that this revelation, which theologians tend to agree is about the hatred of Rome for the persecution of Christians and Jews at that time. And it's an allegory, and it's not meant to be taken literally. And it has dominated Christianity, the whole concept of the Antichrist, the demonic interference with people. And in every generation from the fourth century onwards, somebody comes along and says, and you've got that line in the Gospels themselves where Jesus says that he will return in the lifetime of his followers.
Oh, yeah.
So 10cc wrote a song called Second Sitting for the Last Supper about that, which I will theologically suggest that people look to. But this, so putting this pressure on people, this terrible idea that we have to do this now, there's a strong argument to say that both of the Gulf Wars came out of the billionaire class who are end days Christians. You know, politicians like Reagan was this way inclined, Bush Senior, Bush Junior. They're sort of saying, well, we've got to get all of the Jews back to Jerusalem and convert them to Christianity. And then Jesus will come back. So we don't need to worry about global warming or pollution or anything like that, because Jesus will renew the earth. So you start going, these ideas are very potent. They are dictating the terms of our society from the background, in the background.
Mm-hmm. And no, I agree.
Understanding them and overcoming them and saying, no, somebody took some bad mushrooms and wrote this daft thing down about seven-headed lambs and with seven eyes. It's not a prophecy of the future, and we should not be trying to conform our lives.
But I also think there was a trend in apocalyptic literature. Like, you know, there's the books attributed to Enoch.
The Book of the Secrets of Enoch and the Book of Enoch.
All of that, and the Watchers and that kind of thing. And so these kind of fantastic and poetic attempts to describe the end times, you know, it's like theater. It's like Cecil B. DeMille, you know, when you look at Revelation, and this appealed to a lot of people, and, you know, more so than the dry gospel. And I think that's why it has so much power, because of its aesthetics, not because it's better literature. or more important literature. It's just because the aesthetics in it, you know, these a man with a head of wool and all these serpents and I don't know, you know, the dragon, and it's just all very colorful. It's Harry Potter, it's Star Wars, it's, you know, all of that stuff, and we're attracted more to that than we are what I think would be a realistic or legitimate look at what the teachings were.
Yes. And
you know, which is, you know, it's kind of dull to think that, you know, the Peter arguing with Jesus, you know, what would you have me do? And finally he says, well, just go feed my sheep. Stop arguing with me. You know, do you love me? Well, go feed my sheep if you love me, you know. But it's all this other stuff that's been glued on, like the revelation, is what seems to attract most people, because it moves the emotions. It creates an aesthetic appeal to the senses. And we'd rather have that than the thinking model or the charity model, which is kind of, you're not going to get a whole lot of credit for quietly helping in a soup kitchen, you know.
And
what
having
kind of hero are you? Anybody could do that, you know, that kind of thing.
Making an intellectual dissection of sex in human beings is not as interesting as having sex. Being emotionally, physically engaged with something, and we are incomplete. We cannot be certain because that's reality. We cannot be certain. We cannot know everything.
I think this is where getting back to Hubbard and Manson, where they were able to key in very easily once they got their momentum going with followers that were hanging on all their words and actions and their charisma, so to speak, by creating a life and death scenario. If we don't destroy, we're going to be destroyed. Or if we don't destroy, we can't save the earth, and also the pseudo idea that it's the pressures of the fascist world out there making us commit ritual suicide. And we're doing that to leave a message like Jesus did, you know, as if Jesus committed ritual suicide. When you think about it, I mean, you could spin it and say Jesus did commit ritual suicide. He submitted to dying when the Romans didn't want anything to do with that. They knew it was going to be a problem, but they had to go through with it, which was just another crucifixion to them. They had already done tens of thousands probably that past few years, so no big deal. One more person, you know, let's string them up and get this over with. And they do it very quickly and efficiently. But it became this, you know, I think with Jones, it became this imitation of Christ kind of thing. You know, we are forced into this. The problem, of course, was that he cheated. They took their own lives. No government came in and mowed them down. You know, so if Jesus had stabbed himself in the heart and said something like a samurai, I'm dying an honorable death, you know, then it would have been a completely different religion. But in a sense, the Jonestown people, he got them to stab themselves in the heart or kill them.
Through very careful rehearsal and practice through the White Knights, where they would take, and I did say before we started that we should have a commercial for Flavor Aid, which was in fact what they drank at Jonestown.
Let's make sure people are still, you know, the Kool-Aid has become a meme, and we're not going to get rid of it, like brainwashing is a meme, and we can't get rid of it. Yeah. Even deprogramming has become a meme, and we can't get rid of it.
No.
You know, so we have to constantly look at a bad word, which has a lousy definition, and then redefine it for people continually.
So it goes. And of course, it is the nature of language. The word decimate, used by the Romans to mean that we will kill one in every 10 soldiers if you fail in a campaign. Deci, a tenth, has come to mean much bigger numbers than one tenth. And there are people who object to its use. I'm not one of them. I accept that language changes as we go along. But yeah, drink the Kool-Aid. It put an end to Kool-Aid business, and Flavor Aid was still out there.
Is that true? It affected the Kool-Aid business?
I believe so, yes.
I never looked into that.
When's the last time you saw Kool-Aid on sale?
I haven't bought it for quite a while.
Yeah, exactly. It's gone. It's like there used to be
that would be an interesting article to write. What happened to Kool-Aid? You know, there you go.
Whatever happened to Kool-Aid? We used to have a program of meals for people who are slimming in this country called AIDS. And you don't see that anymore. People selling AIDS.
Right.
You know, it's like hearing AIDS we've kept with, but making that acronym from an acquired immune deficiency syndrome, really, they should have sued the doctors who brought that about for the loss of commercial business. You know? Still.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a movement about to get rid of he and she, male and female, as designations. They can become bad words in the future, and who knows?
And we get into an interesting one with that, which is the word man, which in fact is gender free. And you have a wife, man, or woman. I can't remember what the male version is, but it's like, well, it's got to be person now. Well, should it be per son, or should it be per daughter or per child?
Interesting. In some languages, I know, but in some languages, they don't even have that. Like, for instance, in my Hungarian, you say feleség, meaning half my life, and that goes husband or wife. They are half my life.
Yeah.
So we make a whole, you know, fella, half, shag, life. You know, we are engaged as half lives with one another to make a whole life. There is no woman or man. You know, they both are fellowship.
So, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are the languages similar to that that use the term in a similar way. English has created this sublimation, the woman coming out of the man, and the male man being male when it isn't, but it's male. You know,
and you can go to a language like French or Spanish or Italian, the Romance languages, where things are male or female. Or you can go to German, where they're male, female, or neuter, and there are 36 versions of the word the. Yeah. And it's sort of, I'd like to get rid of all of that. But the idea of, and this is, we won't get into this in any depth today, but the idea of male versus female, because I, at the age of 17, encountered Taoist philosophy and looked, therefore, at the Dai Qi, what people call the yin yang, and said these things are always changing into each other. That's the idea here. That's why there's the black eye in the white tadpole and the white eye in the black tadpole, that one is emerging into the other and these things change. And our simplistic two-dimensional idea of gender might be part of the problem, that these are male characteristics are like being very hairy and being strong, and female characteristics are, you know, not having hair. Well, yes, they do. And being weak, you know, being passive, what have you. Instead of saying, well, let's call them yin and yang, let's stop putting a gender to them, because, of course, as you know, yang means the sunny side of the mountain, and yin means the shady side of the mountain. That's where the terms originate. They later get male and female put upon them. But it instead of having equalism and equality for whatever your determination of your gender, you can be binary, non-binary, whatever, to have equal, absolutely equal rights, rather than getting lost in a kind of pronoun war, would be a wonderful thing. And we're seeing the backlash that you know, a friend of ours was told that he couldn't get a particular job, I won't name him on the air, because he was a white cis male. And as far as I'm concerned, that's prejudice. Pure and simple, because you're blaming all of history on the individual, saying because white cis males did this, you are therefore guilty. And it's like, okay, I didn't do those things. You know, I didn't, I've never kept slaves. You know, I don't consider women to be inferior in any way. And so on and so forth. Why judge me as a generalized category? Because surely that's the problem in the first place, generalized category.
Yeah, I think what you're bringing up is true. It makes a lot of sense, but we are going through a great adjustment, and these adjustments are going a lot more rapidly these days, that makes everyone uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And you know, in this flux, things do emerge as being good, you know, socially. So hopefully someone sorts that out. I got to get going, John.
Yep. Well, I've just got one more recommendation for our viewers.
Yeah.
And that's this here, that go out and grab a copy of this. It's an excellent book. I know the man who proofread it.
Yes. And I have a lot to thank him for because of my lousy English.
Your English is absolutely fine. I didn't have to do any editing work. And it's fascinating. It's an absolutely fascinating account. So I thoroughly recommend that. So, yeah.
Well, one of these days I'm going to make a film out of it. How's that?
That sounds like a good idea, and such things are happening.
Right.
Mark Laxer at the moment, he's spent the last 2 years working on a film of his story after he got a Hollywood offer.
I know. I've worked a bit with Mark. Yeah. In fact, he helped me with my first novel, Mushroom Satori, in terms of creating a new beginning for it when he read the first manuscript. And so we go way back. Of course, especially with the Rama days, among the quote deprogrammers, I was one of the more active removing or helping people choose away from the Zen master Rama thing back in the day. And he hated me.
Oddly enough.
In fact, he feared me. It was interesting. I had to go to New York once, and one of the family members of a Zen master Rama follower asked if he would meet with me in a hotel room while I was in New York just to talk to me about the cult, you know, like an intervention type of thing, but open. Well, the cult member told the group and the leader that I was in New York. The leader, I found out later through that same member, told everybody to hide because Can was in the city. You know, now I'm representing the entire Cult Awareness Network army, and we're all in New York City. We're all going to maybe kidnap people, you know, and that's how much power the deprogrammer is, like the great white shark in the ocean. You know, don't go in the water, you know, because there's a shark out there.
Joe's Imhart's in the water.
So that was
in the Atlantic.
One of the highlights of my career, that I had all this power over this cult leader.
Yeah, it is fascinating with Scientologists that a week or so after I'd resigned publicly, I was in a supermarket, and my former landlady, I hired an apartment from her, I turned to my left, and there she was standing next to me in the supermarket. She saw me at the same moment I saw her. She was at the same level in Scientology I was. She was OT4. I, you know, was on OT5. And she jumped in the air, and she was quite a stout woman, but she actually levitated for a moment and then ran. And to suddenly realize that I'd got this power that I'd never had in Scientology, but now they were scared of me. It's great.
Well, with that, John, I got to get going.
Yep. Thanks very much indeed, Joe. And
all right, thank you.
I'll see you in a couple of months, I hope.
Very good. We'll schedule it later. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good day.